Please include the worldwide outreach of issues, etc. in your year-end giving. With 1 month left in 2018, we're $93,000 short of projected expenses. You can make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible donation by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
You go into your high school government class and you give your opinion defending marriage as between a man and a woman. The class is not going to look at you and say, how brave. Your classmates are going to look at you and say, how intolerant.
They're opposed to femininity, but they're also opposed to masculinity. The worst being in the world is a man. The best being in the world is a male individual who is feminized.
Because on the other side of death for the Christian is not condemnation, is not judgment, but is Jesus who welcomes us and blesses us.
Northern Illinois Chainsaw Drivers, love, issues, etc.
During the recent midterm elections, there were people watching the races for U.S. Senate very closely. It was expected that perhaps the Democrats could eke out a slim majority in the U.S. Senate. They did not manage to do that, but people were alerted to the fact that we are electing one-third of the U.S. Senate. What people may not have realized was that this is not always the way the U.S. Senate was seated in the United States, certainly not in the original Constitution. Now we elect them state by state. The entire state votes for its two senators. But the original Constitution called for a different provision for electing the U.S. Senate. What was it and why was it changed with the 17th Amendment to the Constitution? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Wednesday afternoon, the 5th of December. It's going to be part 7 of our series on the U.S. Constitution. Today, the popular election of senators and the rise of the administrative state. Dr. Russell Dawn joins us. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Give us a brief review of where we've been so far in our conversation.
Well, last time we talked about two challenges to constitutional government that resulted from the Progressive Era emphasis on centralization of power in the federal government for the sake of solving problems. One of these was the broad interpretation of the Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And the other was the passage of a constitutional amendment to permit a federal income tax. Today, we will discuss two additional early 20th century developments that challenged and frankly continue to challenge our constitutional form of government. These are, as you said, the popular election of federal senators and massive growth of the administrative state.
Why did the Constitution originally provide for two legislative bodies, the House and the Senate?
Well, I think the main reason was to mitigate the consequences of what the founders believed was the natural supremacy of the lawmaking power. This was known as legislative supremacy, and in the 18th century, it was a common viewpoint that that is a natural thing, that the lawmaking power is the most powerful. And so this became sort of an intra-branch check and balance.
They originally conceived of the Senate and the House as two very different kind of legislative bodies, although maybe their functions might be roughly parallel. How did they originally provide for the election of the U.S. Senate as opposed to, say, the U.S. House?
Well, the members of the House were to be elected by the people by district. So this is not a statewide election. It is a district-by-district election within each state, but it is very definitely a popular election. But in Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, it stated that senators would be chosen by the legislatures of the state. So, for me, the California state legislature would choose the two federal senators from California. And for you, the Missouri state legislature would choose the two federal senators from Missouri.
What was the thinking behind that method of electing federal senators?
Well, this fit with the founders' notion that the federal government would represent both the states and the people of those states. There was a huge conflict in the Constitutional Convention. The convention called to originally just amend the Articles of Confederation and ended up with a whole new constitution. But the conflict was between big states and small states. And we're not talking about land mass, really. We're talking about population. And so the big states, prominently Virginia, wanted representation to be, and in the legislative branch specifically, they wanted representation to be on a per capita basis. They wanted the people to be represented because there are more of them and it is closer to one person, one vote, which is more democratic. On the other hand, the small states were saying, but in that case, we will never have a true voice in legislation. Really, we'll just be overrun and we'll end up with a tyranny of the majority. And so the compromise was that in this bicameral legislature, there will be two different ways of electing and two different really forms of representation. So on one hand, you have two senators per state, no matter how many people there are in a given state, it's still just two senators. Wyoming has two senators. California has two senators. So that gives the small states, well, at least in one branch of the legislature, a more equal say. Then in addition, since the Senate is already designed to be sort of a non-popular house, if you will, House of Congress, then having the states themselves through their duly elected state legislatures elect senators, that would even more to the point have the Senate as a body representing the states. So it's really, it all comes back to this compromise, if you will, between the big states and the small states that, well, one house will be democratically elected and therefore represent the people, and the other house will be really the representative of the states.
That's a concept that has been almost entirely erased in recent memory, that notion of representing state versus representing the people of the state.
Yes, that has been a long and not obvious process, if you will. I mean, it starts with the post-Civil War amendments. The abuse of power by the southern states meant that the federal government had to take some of the power away from the states. And so those post-Civil War amendments that we talked about a few episodes ago were the first step. The process then continued later that century, later in the 1800s, as populism really arose and anti-elitism arose, and the concept of the government representing the states began to go away, because states became associated with, in some cases, being too cozy with some of the big corporations, some of the dominant corporations at the time. They began to be called trusts. And so this cozy relationship was a matter of concern for populists who wanted as much power in the people as possible. And so, yes, this idea of separately representing the states and also representing the people in a different branch of the legislature has been going strong really ever since the early 20th century.
This notion of a kind of politically insulated Senate in the way that it was elected originally, mm-hmm. and then in its terms, senators obviously serve for 6 years rather than two. And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the notion was this would not just be a more enduring kind of legislative body in terms of the individual senator's terms, but also a more politically insulated legislative body.
Yes, we have to take the founders in their context, otherwise we don't fully understand them. And their context was that they had come out of a world that was very comfortable with aristocracy. Now, there was no aristocracy within America, but the English world, out from which America was born, was comfortable with aristocracy. And so the mixed government that the founders were creating was to have this semi-aristocratic component to it, analogous to, but not identical to, the House of Lords in the British Parliament. So the House of Lords is perpetuated by primogeniture. So if I'm a duke, then my firstborn son becomes duke after me, and it's perpetuated in that way. The Senate is not aristocratic in that sense, because there are elections, but those elections are far enough apart that there is this more enduring voice, as you say, more insulated voice there. And aristocracy literally means not rule by the few, but rule by the best. And so the hope was that the Senate would have the best of America's statesmen.
Just to apply it contemporaneously, in this last month's midterm elections, we heard a lot. Of course, we hear an awful lot nowadays because political opinions are cheap, but we heard a lot about people saying, well, you're trying to tell me that the Senate, we only get two senators from California and Nebraska gets the same number of senators. Shouldn't California get more? Just displays a profound ignorance of the mechanics of the Constitution, at the very least.
Yes, the mechanics as well as the purpose. The idea of mixed government as preventing some of the evils of a concentration of power is an old, old concept, thousands of years old. And so to be so democratically minded that we're not willing to have the aristocratic element within the Senate is just a sign of our lack of civics education. And by the way, I'm hearing more and more from both sides of the aisle this concern about a lack of civics education. And I think that's one benefit of the election of Donald Trump, as the left is concerned about power being concentrated in that person. They begin to see the wisdom of the Constitution. And so hopefully we can have a little bit of a revival of civics education.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest on the other side of the break as we talk about the U.S. Constitution. He says the framers did all they could do to keep government of the people without creating a democracy. We'll find out what he means after this. Please include the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. in your year-end giving. With 1 month left in 2018, we're $93,000 short of projected expenses. You can make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible donation by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
Jesus is the reason for the season. How often do we hear that this time of year? But what if just for a moment we shifted our focus away from the holly jolly holiday season and simply said, Jesus is the reason, period. Join John Kleinig, Heidi Sias, and others as they explore the great and wondrous mystery of Christ's incarnation in the December issue of The Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Several Issues Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations.
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. This child, Jesus Christ, is the focus of every Christmas card that Emmanuel Press offers. Whether in stained glass, illumination, or classic works of art, Christmas cards from Emmanuel Press joyfully confess our Savior's birth with the words of Scripture and the poetry of hymns. Visit their website at emmanuelpress.us to create a custom assortment of cards. emmanuelpress.us.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Wednesday afternoon, part 7 of our series on the U.S. Constitution, we're talking about the popular election of senators and, a little bit later, the rise of the administrative state in the progressive era. Dr. Don, you say that the framers did all they could do to keep government of the people without creating a democracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's coming back to this point of mixed government. Ancient writers feared and even loathed democracy. They generally viewed it as the worst form of government. And that was because of the unpredictability and the oppressiveness of mob rule, of tyranny of the majority. So the founders agreed with this assessment, but they still believed in self-government if the threat of the tyranny of the majority could be kept at bay. So mixing government among the monarchical element, the presidency, the aristocratic in the Senate, and the democratic in the House was their solution to that problem.
Along with that notion of mixed government, it seems sensible to me, looking at it from this side of history, that they might have considered something like term limits for the House or the Senate. Was that ever in their minds?
There is discussion around that issue of, you know, not only should we have term limits, but why did we not have term limits? And part of the reasoning at the time, or I think the main influence behind not having term limits, was the idea of a career politician really was not in their heads, and it was not a very feasible thing. These were among the elite of America at the time. They were largely farmers, and they had farms to take care of. They had hired hands to manage. In some cases, they had slaves to manage. And so they could not spend their full time in the Senate or in the House. And they weren't paid enough in the Senate or the House to want to make it a career. It was just not an attractive option. As we have increased the pay, it has become literally a career track. And I think it would be very wise if we would consider that difference and either drastically reduce the pay so that it's less attractive as a career option or apply term limits.
So give us a brief preview of something we've discussed several times, not only here today, but in previous conversations, or a brief review of the progressive era in the late 19th and early 20th century American politics.
The short version is that as science, which was being discovered by experts, and as technology was being developed by experts, and as Darwinian evolutionary theory was gaining ascendancy, there developed this movement, the progressive movement, with the idea of the perfectibility of humanity, and in this case, the specific issue is perfectibility of society, through expert control. If we just leave things in the hands of experts, they will go better. The chaos of the free market, the development of these monopolies and their oppressive tendencies, this all leads to a feeling that we need to get our arms around this. And the way to do that is through government. There was also in the era a populist mindset that distrusted those with the most power. And they saw the federal government as a way of defending the people from these powerful corporations and their influence on state-level politics.
How did the 17th Amendment then come about, and how did it change the election of the U.S. Senate?
Well, it was adopted officially in 1913, right in the heart of the progressive era, and it says that senators are to be elected by the people of each state rather than by the legislatures.
Given everything we've said so far in our conversation, with the way that this had been carefully designed by the framers, making a change like having an entire state elect two senators would seem to be a pretty big deal. What have been the effects of that change in the manner of electing U.S. senators?
Well, in specific terms, it's difficult to discern because counterfactual history really doesn't work. I sometimes like to engage in it, but we don't have a lot of ways of discerning who would have been elected that wasn't. because of the change. And the longer we go on, the more impossible that becomes. But in general terms, we can say that this diminished the power of the states and made our system more of a democracy, less of a mixed republic, because the ways in which our leaders are elected are closer to being uniform. They aren't identical. Senators are elected by the people of a state. Representatives are elected by the people of a district. And of course, the president is elected by the Electoral College, but they're much closer together. It's very different to have an election by the people of a state rather than by the legislature of a state.
Did it also make these individual Senate seats, in effect, national bodies? I mean, I'm just thinking about why I care whether or not Arizona's Senate seat goes to X or Y. I imagine that in the time when they were being elected by the state legislatures, I probably would not have known nor cared.
Actually, I think that there was a lot of national concern about what was going on in other states. And in fact, part of the problem that was sought to be resolved through making this a popular election was that there were too many backroom deals. There was too much smoke-filled room kind of dealing that was really corrupting influence. We should be cautious about attaching a utopian notion to the way things used to be. The way things used to be included corrupt humanity, and therefore they were corrupt. So we can have corruption in popular elections, corruption in elections through legislatures. So I do think there was actually a more national concern. What there wasn't was national concern among ordinary folks like you and I. It was really the province more of elite opinion, but it was still nationwide opinion.
So how did Franklin Roosevelt, as president, on the heels of the Progressive Era, use the Great Depression as an opportunity to expand federal power through what we have come to know as independent or executive agencies?
Right. Well, for just a brief historical context, the Progressive Era, as you said, is now over, effectively. The Harding and Coolidge administrations saw to that. But that doesn't mean progressivism in that form, in the form that it arose in the late 19th century and early 20th century, was gone. It's just the way that historians divide up the eras. The Progressive Era really ends with the end of World War I. But progressives are still around. Herbert Hoover was a progressive, even though he was in the Republican Party, and FDR certainly was. And so what FDR did is he saw to consolidating the gains of the earlier progressives in the form of this greatly increased administrative state. Remember that progressives believe in government control through the management of society through governmental experts. So in order to do this management or administration, there needed to be more people to execute or carry out this administration of the laws. And those people became employees of newly created administrative agencies. Many of those agencies are still with us today. From the 1930s, we have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Housing Administration, the Federal Communications Commission, and frankly, many, many others. These administrative agencies generally have the authority to make rules that are binding on those whom they oversee. So that's a rulemaking authority. So, for instance, the SEC issues rules that govern those who offer or sell stocks or bonds or other securities. The authority to make those rules comes from Congress. Congress passes a law that includes a provision telling the SEC to make rules to implement or carry out the general purposes of the law that the Congress is passing. That way, Congress doesn't have to become experts in corporate finance in order for the government to control the issuance of securities. The experts in the administrative agency of the Securities and Exchange Commission can do that controlling by making rules as well as executing them. the trade-off there is that they're also less accountable because they have this level of independence.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest on this Wednesday afternoon. It's part 7 of our series on the U.S. Constitution. We're talking about the rise of the administrative state under FDR. When we come back, what effect did this have on the balance of powers between the branches of the federal government? You'll find expert teaching on topics like our first freedoms, Western civilization, revisionist history, abortion, transgenderism, scientism, and more on a recording of our 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. We'll send you an audio DVD or a thumb drive for a year-end tax-deductible contribution of $300 to Issues Etc. You can order online at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Almost 20 hours of teaching and preaching on a recording of this year's Making the Case conferences. We'll be right back with Dr. Russell Dawn talking about the U.S. Constitution and the rise of the administrative state.
Well, a human nature is what makes you human and not a dog or a fish or a turtle. Your human nature is what sets your ultimate capacities and determines the kind of thing you are. You don't get a human nature in degrees. You either have it or you don't. There's no degree involved.
Scott Klusendorf speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Well, people today are quite willing to concede that you have a human nature. They're willing to concede I do, but they don't want to concede that embryo is. And here's the question you put to them when they challenge you. How do two human parents create offspring that isn't human, but later becomes so?
You can listen to Scott Klusendorf's presentation, Making the Case for Life, and all the speakers at our 2018 Making the Case conferences on an audio DVD or flash drive. We'll send it to you for a $300 year-end tax-deductible donation. Look for the link at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
This is Pastor Clint Poppy, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, proud supporter of Issues Etc. Each month we host the Nebraska Lutherans for Confessional Study, a serious study of Lutheran theology. We generally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month from 9:30 to 2:30, and both clergy and laity are invited. There is no charge to attend. For more information, please call the church office or visit our website, goodshepherdlincoln.org, and click on the green NLCS tab.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're talking about the U.S. Constitution and the rise of the administrative state in our series on the Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. Dr. Dawn, we were talking about the rise of the administrative state under FDR. What effect did this have on the balance of powers between the branches of the federal government?
Well, the biggest problem here is that Congress has effectively delegated a large portion of its lawmaking powers to individuals who are parts of these agencies, individuals who have not been elected by the people to make laws. We elect senators and representatives to make laws. If other people are making laws, they're doing so without the direct connection to the people. The powers of legislating and of executing the laws have been joined within one agency. And of course, you then multiply that across all the agencies.
Does that mean that these independent agencies, to one degree or another, operate as both maker and enforcer?
That's correct. When I say legislating and executing, that is precisely the outcome. And so the EPA ends up, in effect, making laws and executing them and judging them as well.
How is that not a government within a government?
I cannot think of a way. I'm far from the first person to think of this problem. And there are measures put in place to try to insulate more. I suppose it's fair to say it's not quite as bad as I just made it sound. It's not purely a political appointment, if you will, from within the agency. That being said, it is severely problematic, and it has been challenged in the courts, but it's always been upheld in every significant way. So the delegation of Congress's authority to make laws was viewed as not actually a delegation, not a dereliction of duties, if you will, but simply that Congress still is making the laws. The administrative agencies, of course, can't make rules that go outside of those laws. They have to be within the scope of the laws, of those enabling laws that Congress has passed. But really, I think it was somewhat of a beholden Supreme Court that made that decision, and beholden in part by societal circumstances. Already fairly far down that road, are we really going to dial back the entire executive agency animal, if you will? I think that would have been difficult. Not to say they shouldn't have made the decision, but it would have been a difficult decision to make.
The framers envisioned these three branches of government being kind of jealous for their own bailiwicks and powers, and then able to tinker in one another's to a certain degree. But it raises a question, why would Congress delegate its legislative powers in this way?
That's a great question. I think it is partly viewed as a way to extend their powers. Although they're giving up part of their legislative powers, they are able to extend their powers into the lives of their constituents more completely and into the lives of the corporations, into the dealings of everything that's going on in America. So in a way, it is an extension of power, even though it's a reduction of the direct power of making laws.
Indulging in a bit of what you called a moment ago counterfactual history, what would it look like today had Roosevelt not expanded, even to the extent that he did, federal power as he did?
Well, assuming not only that he didn't do it, but that those who came after him didn't, you'd have to say that it'd be impossible for the federal government to control our lives and businesses to the extent that it does. Congress couldn't possibly write as laws all of the federal rules that exist today. There simply aren't enough members of Congress to tackle such a job. So we would have more powerful states. They would surely take on some of the regulating that the federal government currently does. And we would have a federal government with a fraction of the power that it currently possesses, and quite likely more freedom and responsibility as individuals.
What are then the practical trade-offs for citizens regarding these unelected agencies and commissions?
If we didn't have as much federal control, as much governmental control over our lives, we would, in addition to having more freedom and responsibility, we would bear more risks because we wouldn't have federal financial safety nets beneath us, federal safety rules surrounding us, etc. For most Americans, life is far cleaner, healthier, and less risky because of big government. Of course, as the libertarians would remind us, we cannot know how much a freer market might have improved our conditions beyond what big government has been able to do. But we do ourselves a disservice, I think, if we imagine a liberty-based utopia, as I said before. If only big government hadn't gotten in the way, everything would be fine. Well, no, we're fallen and corrupt, and there is no utopia, whether created by big government or by freedom. There's only, you know, muddling through a desperately imperfect world, resting on the love of God in Christ and his gracious provision of all that we need.
Some follow-up questions. I'm curious about your reflections on in an attempt to fix one big problem, and that is, as you said, the cozy relationship that the states may have had with these monopolistic business interests and progressivism trying to solve that problem, inadvertently creating a much bigger problem, a much bigger potential for the expansion of governmental power, not through business interests now, but through bureaucracy.
Sure. And that's really the human condition. We are perpetually getting ourselves out of a frying pan and into a fire, or maybe out of a fire, but still into a frying pan because of the fall and because of how pervasive the effects of the fall are. It will never be perfect. And every time we solve one problem, we raise at least one other problem, and sometimes they are bigger. You know, sometimes we get things more right, and sometimes we get things less right. I think in the drafting of the Constitution, they had a very good grasp of human nature, and so we're able to get things more right. But it did create other problems, as it's wont to do. As I said, the circumstances are such that we're continually trying to put out fires.
Are you familiar with Purnell's Iron Law of Bureaucracy?
I have heard of it, but I'm not familiar.
Well, I mean, it's just basically the observation that in any bureaucracy, those who are who dedicate themselves to the survival of the bureaucracy itself generally tend to rise to levels of leadership, whereas those who have the noble goals of the bureaucracy in mind get less and less influential over the course of time. This seems to be kind of the lesson of the many changes we have tracked here in the U.S. Constitution in the last several weeks.
Absolutely. And it's funny that that's the iron law of bureaucracy, because I have seen it before in my own work life that, as you say, perpetuating the institution becomes inadvertently more important than perpetuating the, as you say, noble goals of the institution. We can watch and see, for instance, as Google and Apple and other massive corporations, will they move down that road, or will their good goals continue to be center?
Another thought that occurs to me here, Dr. Don, is that with the expansion, we're not only talking about an expansion of influence, power, there are benefits, of course, as well. I like the idea that my money is federally insured.
Sure.
In the bank. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So there are benefits there as well. But there's also the cost of doing all of this. This has greatly expanded the cost, not just the size and pervasiveness of government, but its cost as well.
Yes. I don't think that as Americans, we really have a good concept of how disconnected the average late medieval or early modern peasant was from the crown. Certainly the crown had influence out in the counties, out in the shires, if you will, through the sheriff in particular, and through having some power over the lords, the aristocrats. But mainly local life was local, and what the crown did from day to day or even from year to year was often not even known to the average villager, the average farmer. So with it's just that level of detachment and, in a way, freedom. They didn't even realize that they had freedom because they hadn't ever conceived of such an invasive federal government as what we have now. So I think we have difficulty conceiving of their lives, and they would have difficulty conceiving of ours. That's not to romanticize the poverty and difficulties of the medieval age. I would not prefer to live then over now, but there were some advantages, and we would be wise to recognize that we don't have it all figured out and we're not necessarily better off in every category.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. More on the U.S. Constitution and the locality of politics after this. "'Twas the night before Jesus, when all through the earth every creature was stirring for a new baby's birth. Words from The Night Before Jesus, Concordia Publishing House's new Christmas book. The Night Before Jesus would make a great Christmas gift for children, grandchildren, and godchildren ages 3 through 5. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, The Night Before Jesus."
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. Zion Lutheran, Pleasant Plains, Illinois. Peace Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Mount Olive Lutheran, Duluth, Minnesota. Bethlehem Lutheran, Parma, Ohio. Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin. Emmanuel Lutheran, Eagle, Nebraska. St. Paul Lutheran, Hamel, Illinois. Our Savior's Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. And Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at the website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Come, O Precious Ransom, Come. Playing right now at our 24/7 sacred music station, Lutheran Public Radio. Listen anytime, anywhere at lutheranpublicradio.org and on the LPR mobile app. Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the Advent season. We're talking about the U.S. Constitution, and we're dealing with the rise of the administrative state and the change of the way that U.S. senators are elected. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. Dr. Dawn, I'm curious, the framers were concerned about, we would say today, keeping politics local. With the changes we've discussed here, what happened to the localness of government?
Yes, I think that has changed, but it hasn't necessarily gone away. I'm not a political scientist, and so I don't study the social science, if you will, of sort of the mood of an electorate and the how national versus local politics occur on a day-to-day basis, if you will. But those who are political scientists, those I try to follow and keep up with on this, still talk about this concept. And I actually think the midterm elections are a great example of this. Setting aside the possibility of corruption in a number of the races, because we can't know for sure whether a given race was corrupt, at least we can't yet. Look at so many suburbs. My own suburb here in, or kind of collection of suburbs here in Central Orange County, California, partly because of what's going on at a national level with the Trump phenomenon, positively and negatively, partly because of that, our previous representative just got unseated by someone who is really politically very far away from the current representative, Mimi Walters. The new representative, Katie Porter, is very much to the left, whereas Walters, I think, would be right to be seen as center-right. So that is a local change. That's a suburban change. We saw the same thing in a suburb of Oklahoma City and elsewhere, places where it was very surprising that these very red districts went blue in the midterms. Well, that's a localized phenomenon. And so I do think that politics can still be local and are still local to at least some extent.
So are you saying that, especially at the midterms, when we're looking at where the president is, as much as he can be, taken out of the spotlight of American elections, we still see the locality of politics?
Absolutely. And we see local reactions to what's going on nationally.
How did the relationship between the actual elected officials when it came to the Senate, how did that change with the 17th Amendment to their electorate? That is, I don't know if they were traveling back to do campaigns or something like that, but if you're elected through a back deal in the state's legislature, the only people you have to campaign among are the people who make that decision. How did that change the mechanics there?
Yeah, exactly as you say, Todd. Really, instead of focusing exclusively on the power brokers in a particular state who are close to the legislature or within the legislature, now those who would seek senatorial office would have to appeal to the people, at least to some extent. Now, there's still, and even to this day, there is still a lot of backroom dealings among the elite, among those who have power, getting the power of your party behind you so that they can get local networks at work to get you elected. That sort of thing is very much a deal among elites. And that still goes on. But now there is this added component of what do the people think? Or I guess I should say, in fairness, it's a greater emphasis on that added component of appealing to the people, because that was already there indirectly in the old way. Because if a state legislature made a habit of appointing as senator people that the populace didn't want, then those members of the state legislature might find their tenure in the legislature quite limited. So there was still a popular component. This just greatly increased the popular component.
One of the things that the recent midterms made headlines for, Dr. Dawn, was how expensive it is to run for Senate in the United States. And I'm wondering about the shift there from, it might have been expensive, you might have been greasing bigger palms maybe before the 17th Amendment, but now you have to spend millions of dollars. And now we've topped, in the case of, I believe, a Florida race, maybe going close to $200 million for a senatorial election. What are your thoughts there in terms of just the cost of getting elected?
Yes, well, that's reason number 50 that I won't ever be an elected official. But yeah, it's crazy. A lot of it has to do with the rise of mass media, televised media, although even that is changing. The influence of social media, which from what I understand is a less expensive way of reaching the people, it's still, we're dealing with more people, you know, enormous numbers of people compared to even a century ago, and much more careful crafting of images, hiring more and more people in order to create this crafted image. And really, the whole thing has become a more polished machine than the old backroom cigar smoking machine.
Has that changed at the other end? The power of incumbency in the U.S. Senate. If I can afford to get myself elected in the modern era at post-17th Amendment, I can probably build myself a war chest sufficient to make myself almost bulletproof.
Sure. Not only a war chest, but a name recognition, a sense, you know, you have the opportunity while a senator to do things that your constituents like, things that your constituents favor. And so to build up goodwill that an outsider just doesn't have.
I'm a little stunned at this point in our conversation by how much actually has changed. We've been discussing these things. These amendments were not ineffectual. They were actually amending the way that American politics works to a really great degree.
Yes. Again, we can't calculate exactly what degree because we can't know what would have happened without the amendments. But this is significant. I actually had a student who's a very politically aware student actually wanted to go into policy, ending up being effectively a policy wonk. So I really respected his opinion. And his view was the 17th Amendment was actually more significant than some of the surrounding progressive era amendments, but in ways that we can't quite see. And that's part of the significance of it, he thinks, that really the idea of democracy rather than of Republican, think small r Republican, think mixed government, has really just transformed the way that Americans think. That emphasis on democracy, on equality, this egalitarianism is, well, it's always been somewhat part of the American mystique, but not to nearly the extent that it has been since 1913.
Without indulging utopian hopes for the future or the past, can we realistically think about ways to dial down the expansion of the federal government as we have discussed it here in this last hour?
Well, there are ways, but whether we can think about them in a realistic sense, I'm not sure. I think Americans love their Santa Claus government. They love to receive things. Even many of the most conservative, most red states receive huge amounts of federal funding for the various things that they want. So there isn't a lot of standing on principle where, no, we're conservatives, fiscal conservatives, constitutional conservatives, we believe in small government, so we're not going to take government money and we're going to be as independent of the federal government as we can be. You just don't see that, and there are very few incentives for doing so. So I think realistically it would take a transformation of culture before we could transform the government. I'm far from the first to say that politics is downhill from culture. And so really it is that level of transformation, reappropriation of the idea of freedom, meaning, responsibility, and a reappropriation of things like the natural law or ideally Christianity itself and our need for a savior. These things need to become part of the culture again before we can expect a big transformation of government.
Next time, what are we going to be looking at, Dr. Don?
For the next two episodes, if you will, we'll be looking at the idea of the Constitution as a living document, as an evolving document. This is about a century old idea, slightly over a century old, and it has utterly transformed the branch of government we haven't talked all that much about, and that's the judicial branch.
Dr. Russell Dawn is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he is a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, thank you very much for your time.
Always a treat.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss media coverage of the faith of George Herbert Walker Bush with Terry Mattingly. And in the aftermath of the murder of a missionary to a remote tribe in India, we'll talk with Pastor Dan McMiller of LCMS International Mission about the opportunities and the risks of international mission work. You have until December 14th to take advantage of getting 0.25% off a new car loan, courtesy of the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. You'll find additional information at lutheranfcu.org. The Lutheran Federal Credit Union, good for you, good for the church. lutheranfcu.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we are committed to our Lutheran confession and heritage. Please encourage the student in your life to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is. 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.